My lack of rushing to judgment has just come with time and experience.
Dr. Sekou Gathers, welcome to Saturday Brunch. Thank you for having brunch with me.
Hey, what's happening? What's happening? What's going on? How you feeling? How you feeling?
I've got to say, moving to New York has been quite a journey for me, and, and I've loved moving here and having people like you to teach and navigate me through. You know, I mean, you've introduced me to certain people like Duke Garone, who I train with.
Duke Garone.
And he helps me speak to people in an appropriate manner. Or maybe not so appropriate sometimes. He goes, no, Ginny, you can't say that. You can't call them sneakerheads.
Right.
You can't. Yeah. So it's been great.
The lingo. He's helping you with the lingo.
He is.
It's good.
So it's actually great to catch up for brunch. So I wanted to actually get to know you.
Okay.
On a deeper level.
Deep. Let's go deep.
We're going deep
underground,
over this smashed avocado. And high Australian standard coffee here.
Okay.
So, Dr.
What's
G,
happening?
You, like, tell me a little bit. You grew up in New York City in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And now you live across the river
across the pond.
So, tell me, growing up in Brooklyn, the time that you did, it was obviously the time of pre-Biggie days. And obviously, Brooklyn was a little bit
pre-Biggie,
pre-Biggie. Not as gentrified as it is now and as hipster.
No.
So, tell me, what was it like growing up in, was it Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, that
I grew up in Brownsville.
Brownsville.
And then I moved to Bed-Stuy.
Gotcha.
Probably when I was around 13, 14, my parents got divorced and my mom got a place in Bed-Stuy. So that's where I was at.
When I was 4, my parents got divorced. I wasn't quite aware of what that meant.
Because,
you know, you're a child, you're 4, you're like, okay, well, dad's not coming home tonight. This feels different for me.
Right.
So for me, it kind of, I guess all that blissful ignorance was a bubble I was living in. And then later on, it kind of popped. I'm like, oh, that's what it meant.
Right.
You know, when you go through Father's Day and you go to your friends' places and they have two parents there, you kind of understand. You were 13 when your parents split up.
Yes.
How did you process that?
I didn't process it because the way that I found out was very interesting.
Really?
So one day I was just at home. I mean, I knew my parents were having issues. And my mom was like, I want you to come with me somewhere. And, you know, this is in my life, you know, 13, 14 years at that point, I had gone thousands of places with her. So it was no big deal. So we get in the car, we're driving, we, you know, come to this place, this block, we park, we get out. And then we walk up the stairs and then she has a key and then we go in. I'm like, okay. And we walk in and I see this huge spiral staircase. And I'm like, oh, shit, what is this? And then she's like, we're going to be living here.
You know, I gotta say, wow, I had something similar too. Not as quite, I didn't have the poetic stairs, but
I was four,
we were on the top level of our apartment, and my uncle and cousin were coming, and they started packing our stuff. It was in the middle of the night, and I'm like, what are we doing? Mom's like, we're going to be moving house. And I saw my sister kind of, she didn't really engage in the conversation. She was really pensive and silent.
Right.
So things were getting packed. And then there was these metal chairs we had in the kitchen that I used to love dragging across the floor, as you do when you're bored and three have nothing to do.
Right.
And then my mom said, we're moving house because you make too much noise. I'm like, okay, cool. Then we moved house and we moved to this flat in Northcote, which was in the city of Melbourne. And
was it smaller than where you lived or larger?
About the same size. And I remember moving there and I said, is dad coming? And she's like, nope. So I think hopefully, you know, 20, 30 years later in hindsight, I'm hoping the conversations around divorce, I mean, just a tip for parents, give your children the heads up.
And then to continue my story to make it worse, when I got back home, my father was like, where were you?
What were you supposed to do?
I mean, the bus was on top of me. I was under it looking up at the exhaust. I was completely under the bus. I was like, well, we went to the other house. And he was like, what other house? And then I was like, the place where we're going to be living. And then, you know, him and my mother proceeded to have, you know, some big argument. But that's how I found out. I mean, on one instance, I understood it, but I didn't really process it. I mean, I didn't probably process it until I was in my 30s. I mean, and I'm 42 now because it's a lot. I think all kids want all children want their parents to be together and they're, you know, heart of hearts. And it took a long time for me to come to grips. I mean, I understood my father's issues. I didn't like the way my mother, you know, told it to me. I felt, you know, sort of betrayed and then threw me under the bus, you know, when I got home.
Yeah.
Like, okay. As I've gotten older, I've understood her issues, you know. So
yeah.
it's all kind of making sense. And then, you know, the podcast that we just recorded reminded me that my mom grew up with an alcoholic father. And so, you know, these things come into play into the formula of who she is and of who they are. So interesting.
It's interesting you talk about how you dealt with that in your 30s. I'm curious. Yeah. In the time that I've known you, you're a pretty empathetic dude. Like something goes on and you're not the kind of person who looks at it and is like, you quickly jump to judgment.
Right.
You actually go, well, what's actually going on here? What's the contributing factors? You unpack
right.
it.
Right.
Do you think one of those moments that you just talked about, your parents divorcing, the empathy and I guess what you developed to kind of look at your mum like, oh, okay, well, she was going through this and your dad. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's helped you, been a reason that's helped you develop to the empathetic person that you are?
Well,
today.
I didn't have that empathy then. I mean, I didn't, it wasn't even about empathy. It was just about not dealing with my feelings around. I was hurt. I was angry. I was afraid. I was all the emotions you could think of when your whole world literally is split apart. Right.
Yeah.
The empathy basically came with not even empathy, but my lack of rushing to judgment has just come with time and experience. You know, when I have rushed to judgment, it fell flat on my face because I was 1,000% wrong about the story I was telling myself about why said thing happened. And it happens all the time. And I tell people, you know, even on my show, The Truth Prescription, that was a plug, that the brain is not meant to figure out unknowns. The brain is meant to figure out known quantities. So that's why it's very good at math and very good at, you know, designing and planning, you know, building a house and drawing. And all these things are known entities. But when you're talking about what you don't know, like what's inside of somebody's head, why somebody did something, the brain doesn't work. But we come up with stories all the time because we want to be right, because the ego needs to be right. And there's been, I would say 80% of the time in my coming to this behavior, 80% of the time I was wrong. So I realized, you know what?
Hi, this is Brooke Devard from Naked Beauty. Are you tired of feeling housebound? I sure am. Break free with the new Unbound Cordless Auto Curler from Conair. It's a high-performance auto curler that's rechargeable and gives you up to 60 minutes of cord-free runtime. Just think of all of the incredible hair looks you can create in 60 minutes, unbound, away from your wall. Don't get tied down by cords. Love your look. Live unbound. Check it out at Conair.com and search Unbound.
I mean, I jump to conclusions. Let me give a person the benefit of the doubt and let me think about what other things could be going on other than my thought that it's some negative thing against me. And then secondly, what role did I play? And usually when I try to figure out what role did I play or if do I do the same thing, that's the other thing, then you start to have compassion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a hard muscle to flex, isn't it, time?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's easier for me now, but yeah, it takes practice.
It's interesting what you said about stories.
Yeah.
Because we do tell ourselves stories around. And we wrap stories around situations and it obviously skews our perception.
Oh, yeah.
And I think a story, from what I've learned from doing the podcast, you know, it takes a conversation to really change perspective on something. And I think I told you, had a conversation with you previously, how I went to this event and the girl who ran the event, she just randomly paired two artists together because she wanted them to create something. So it could be a singer with a dancer, go create something.
Cool.
So a conversation can really create something.
Yeah.
So you were talking before about how, you know, we wrap stories around things. I also think that the stories really, it takes over our hearing because you're telling me something, but I'm hearing something completely else.
Yes, it's, I agree. 100%.
I think that's a pain point of conversation.
Yeah.
As a doctor, I can imagine that you have to deliver sometimes some pretty horrible news.
Yes.
How do you remain in that, I guess, state of, I'm having a conversation with you, I've got to tell you some, it's hard not to, how do you not get compassion fatigue is what I'm trying to say.
Compassion fatigue. Interesting. That's a good question. Because I'm an ER doctor, I have to tell people that their loved ones have died probably more than other doctors.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's actually something that I got training on when I was doing my emergency medicine residency. back in at Mount Sinai back in, when did I train? 03 to 06. I don't know. I mean, if I sit here on this microphone and say there have been times when I've gone in the room and just completely, you know, been robotic, I have. I mean, that's the honest truth.
Yeah. It gets molded into a job.
It's a task, and it's usually a task among 89 other tasks that I have to do within a 12-hour period so I can get my day done, wrap up my work, and be able to go home at a decent time and not be staying in the hospital after my shift. But I will say that more often than not, and it's a majority of the time, particularly as I've worked on myself and really worked on my level of consciousness, my level of awakeness, and my meditation practice, I usually, when I go into the room, I put myself in almost like a meditative state. And I speak as much as I can from the heart and be compassionate for their situation. Because, you know, if I was sitting in their seat, how would I feel? And you know, I can do it 10,000 times, but each person is different. Each person reacts differently. And there's definitely almost a script that we go through when I have to tell somebody that their loved one has died. But I just think it's the way that you say something and the manner in which you say it, even if it's the same thing,
yeah,
that dictates how a person receives it. They always say that a person remembers what you feel, how they felt when you talk to them, not necessarily what you say. I always say the analogy of if two guys were sitting at a bar and Jesus was on his left side and a random dude was on his other side, and the random dude was like, "Brother, I love you," right? And then Jesus said, "Brother, I love you." Which one would be more impactful? Right?
It would be Jesus.
Because Jesus actually lives love. He's the embodiment of love. Yeah. So I just, you know, it's about the manner in which you say something. And so I try to bring that level of ground my own self, and my own level of sensitivity to the situation.
Right.
If that answers your question.
That does answer my question. It's the layer of empathy that I was talking about.
Yeah.
So tell me, when was it? You're a creative guy. You have a podcast. Yeah. You
write films.
You film, direct them. You act.
Right.
I'm curious. So we kind of skip from 13 to 30.
Yeah.
I want to kind of fill in the gap a little bit.
Good luck.
When did you kind of, I guess, when did it dawn upon you that you wanted to be a doctor?
Oh, that was early. That was probably 8 or 9.
Right. Why was that?
Well, I really like science. Because science explains things. And that's why I liked it. Because, you know, as a kid, you're living in this world where there's, you know, all these grand things happening around you that are not really clear.
Right.
But science was like, oh, this is why water is what it is. Oh, you got 2 molecules of this and 1 molecule of this. Oh, okay. That makes sense. So I like science. And I did well in science academically. I did really well in science. So, and then one day my dad, you know, it was really my dad that put the idea in my head. I knew I liked science, but I didn't know I wanted to be a doctor. And my dad said, literally, quote, end quote, "Why don't you think about being a doctor? I think you'd be a good doctor." Just like that. So that's it.
Wow. Just like that.
It's like that.
And then he literally spoke it into existence.
Literally.
Right, right.
It happened. Even though, you know, I had my... We could talk about, but I had my my detours along the way.
Right, right.
Detour.
Where did you detour to? I'm curious now.
Where did I detour to?
Yeah.
Well, when I was in high school, my dad actually got me into this program where I had to go to a program after school, and I had to go 2 Saturdays a month to basically this like academic enrichment thing. And if I would have went through the program, it was like basically just to do 2 years to the end of high school, I'd have been guaranteed admission into City College for free. And I'd have been guaranteed admission into, I think it was Einstein Medical School for free.
Wow.
And my butt stopped going because I was like, man, I don't want to do this. It's too much work. I want to get a job so I can buy jeans and polo boots and Hilfiger. And
polo boots, specific.
I want to be fly. Yes. They cost $172.12. I just remember the
day.
And I wanted to buy them. Everybody was rocking them. So I needed to have them. So I stopped going to the program.
Yeah.
And they didn't tell him. And he found out about it. He was hot. He was so pissed at me. Understandably, you know, as a parent now, I get it. So I ended up, you know, doing it the hard way.
I do have a burning question. Did you end up buying those 172.11?
Hell yeah, of course. Yeah, I went to work. You know, I went to work. I worked on Saturday instead of going to this program, and I worked after school instead of going to the program. And I made money. I had a check, and I went and bought my boots.
It's almost like you out hustled your actual hustle.
That was just dumb.
But you have to
go through those things. I think as a young person, you got to kind of
figure it out
and figure out that you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you should listen to people. Yeah.
Well, I think for me, the way I look at that is you were kind of trying to get a taste for what you really wanted. Like, you know, sometimes you need to dabble into the, you need to detour sometimes to be like, yeah, I kind of want to go back to that route again.
I guess. I mean, it was just completely materialistic reasoning. You know, I wanted to be fly like the other kids, and my parents weren't buying that. So I wanted to buy. I want to have money so I can buy it.
Yeah.
And I remember, it's funny. I remember, like, I'm an only child, and I grew up, you know, quote unquote, spoiled or whatever. But I remember the moment when I got that thing in me to say, oh, I can, you know, if I want something, I need to do it myself, which was one day my mom, you know, she made me pancakes, and she always used to cut my pancakes for me, you know, cut them up, and I eat them. And then one day, for whatever reason, I had to be like, I was probably like 10 or 11. She put the pancakes on the table, and she hadn't cut them. And I was like, Ma, can you cut my pancakes? She was like, why? And I said, because that's what women are supposed to do.
Dear, your ass must have gotten whoops, thank you. I'm going to whoop you down those spiral stairs. Or you
went there, I went there. However, my pancakes never got cut, okay? So that we know.
That's what women are supposed to do. I bet you never said something like that ever again.
This is the message. But I got the message from my father. Yeah. My father was the straight, like, he was male chauvinist. Straight up.
Yeah.
You know, old school male chauvinist.
Right.
So anyway, she obviously didn't cut my pancakes.
Right.
And, but from that moment, I realized, all right, well, I guess I got to do these things myself.
Yeah.
And I figured out how to cut my own pancakes. And, you know, from there on, that was sort of my attitude about things, that if I want something, I'm going to go get it.
It's not a woman's job to do it for you. Wow.
You like that?
I like that.
You know me a long time. You've never heard that story.
I never heard that. So I was like, okay, this gives me some perspective. Next time we go out for pancakes, I'm like, I'm not going to buy them for you. I'm glad you didn't order these for brunch. Wow, okay. This is interesting. Okay, it brought out a lesson for you. You learned if there's something that you want, you got to get it yourself. So you became a doctor. Obviously, there was a creative side inside you that was, I guess, igniting.
Always there, yeah.
How did you express that?
When?
When or how? Like, you were going through medical school, you became a doctor. Did you have some...
afterward?
Yeah.
So, actually, when I left high school, I went to Music and Art for Performing Arts, also known as the Fame School. They made a movie about it and a TV show. And I actually played viola. I was a violist my 4 years at school.
Nice.
Always loved music. And I had started dabbling in music production and actually, you know, rapping. I had a rap album out when I was in high school, and actually sold like 900 copies, and it was starting to gain traction. But I wasn't confident enough to pursue that because the record label that I was working for, that put the record out, wanted me to come up to their office and like basically show them how I would perform if I had a show.
Right.
And I like just got terrified, and I basically never went back.
Wow.
Well, you can find it on YouTube. It's called Narcotic Jazz. Anyway.
Narcotic Jazz.
Yeah. Anyway, so my point is this creativity has always been there. So when I finished college, I went to college, didn't really do too much in college in terms of creativity. But when I went to med school, I started started up again. What was I doing? Did I do anything in med school? Again, med school, not too much. But it was at the end of med school, right when I first got my first, I was an intern, but it was getting paid. I had a check. I started buying little equipment here and there. And my uncle, shout out to Azel, my uncle worked at Sam Ash at the time. So I was able to get some equipment.
Mm.
And then one time I went there just on a whim, and I actually won, like, it was like a raffle. I went... And I put my name in this thing. It was this big thing. It was like 100 people in the store.
Mm.
And I won this like $3,000 piece of equipment, Pro Tools, the Digi 002.
Yeah.
And like that kind of started, you know, I started producing, making music, working with artists, and while I was, you know, doing my training.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Sekou the Rapper, I did not know that. I saw a little bit of a hint in one of your episodes. You're like, tip and point. I'm like, okay, boy can rap too. he's a rap artist. This is great. Okay. I'm learning so much about you.
Yes, you didn't know that you
had your pancakes cut for you till you were 10, that you had 900 copies of a rap album.
Yeah.
Gotta get my hands on that. Sold too.
Yeah.
So, there was obviously a shyness in you because you didn't want to publicly perform.
Right.
So obviously over time now you host a podcast.
Yeah.
You were on the verge of releasing a book.
Yeah.
Confidence built up.
Yeah, I'm still shy.
You're still shy.
Yeah.
Yes, you are. But obviously it's you've been working on your confidence and, you know, your empowerment. And like, what have you done to kind of work on that? Like, tell the people of the Ginny Show.
Yeah.
What have you done to learn to step into your confidence / empowerment?
Stop living for others.
That's really at the core of it, isn't it?
That's the core. I mean, I could talk a long time, but that's really the core. Stop living for others and others' expectations and others' desires for you. And that's a whole, that's 18 podcasts.
Yeah.
It takes a long time. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of courage, but mainly the will. And I think it all goes back to once you stop living for other people, then you start focusing on, well, what is it that I actually want? What does Sekou want? What does Genie want?
Yeah.
You know, what do we want?
Yeah.
And when you figure that out, as you figure that out, it starts guiding you in certain directions. And then you realize, you know what? There's no other option for me.
Yeah.
So this shyness, you know, it is what it is. I'll deal with it. I'll, you know, but I don't have another option. Like this is me.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a very powerful statement. And some people don't really, when you look at approval that we seek from others and I guess validation.
Yeah.
I mean, we speak a lot about this on The Truth Prescription and we speak a lot about this on The Ginny Show is that kind of self-approval that we need to start with. And it's true. I think a lot of people when they're in their 40s or in their 50s, when they have that regret or they have that anger or some pent-up frustration, it comes from a point where they let their lives be governed by someone else's expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be 50, 40, 60, how old I am.
Yep.
And I don't want to feel that resentment towards my parents. I mean, my parents weren't perfect. I don't think any parents are.
No.
But I don't want to look at them and be like, yo, I did all of this for you and now I'm miserable.
Yeah.
Because I've got to take that accountability on board, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It becomes, I don't want to look at them and be upset to, I don't want to look at myself and be upset when I'm 85. When I'm 85, I want to have no regrets at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all.
No regrets.
I just want to be like, listen, even if I'm unsuccessful, which I don't think, but at least I know the success for me is that I tried everything, you know, and I gave it my all. And, you know, I didn't let fear stop me.
But what is success these days? I think it can only be defined by yourself when you think about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because I can look at someone who's got, like, who's invested in, you know, 5 companies and not working at all and just living off the interest of them. I think that could be success for someone. But someone who's hustling 24/7, building a future, building a company, I think success is personally defined. But going back to that point, as a father of 3, you've got 3 beautiful daughters.
Yes.
What advice would you give them, or what advice do you and your wife try to kind of give them to create a life that they love?
The advice is,
I know they're still young, but
they're young. I mean, well, my oldest, I have a 14-year-old previous marriage, and 2 almost 3-year-old, and 11 almost 12 almost a year old, 11-month-old. I mean, the 2 young ones, my message to them is basically going to be, do you, be you.
Yeah.
Don't worry about me. Try everything. Just be unlimited in your gaze, in your thought process, in your experiences. Just be open, you know, just be open. But I think the main thing is be you, just be you. My oldest daughter, it's similar. She's Nia. She's shy.
So she's quite like you in that sense.
Yeah. And I think, you know, she had a traumatic, I mean, you know, similar to, I mean, you know, her mother and I divorced when she was, I mean, stopped living together when she was 4.
Yeah.
Divorce finalized, you know, a little later, but I think that's traumatic for her, and I don't think she's dealt with it. It'll take her some time to deal with it, but my main thing for Nia is just, like, she's afraid of everything.
Mm.
So just be bold and don't be afraid. With her, it's a little bit harder because we don't live together, so I can't. But when I talk to her, you know, I try to drop little hints here and there. She'll be fine. The universe takes care of everybody. I'm her father for a reason, and
exactly.
I'm in the role I am
not
living with her for a reason. And she's got her lessons to learn that she's going to learn. And then same thing for my little ones. You know, I'm in their life for a reason. It's all been preordained.
Yeah.
You know, my mother used to say that, she still says that, we choose our parents before we come here.
I agree.
So
I agree with
you. If you believe that,
yeah,
then everybody's got what they need. That's why even in the previous podcast, we were talking about how both, you know, healthy and unhealthy relationships are good for you.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I'm not an alcoholic father, but if I was, then that's clear, that would be what they needed.
I mean, I think it's so true. I think about my current romantic relationship.
Yeah.
And the amount of unhealthy relationships I had to go through to get to a healthy one.
Yeah.
It's true. If it wasn't for the unhealthy ones, I wouldn't have been so, you get, I guess, closer to what you want and that your self-worth as to what you want for you and the life you want to create with the person you want to spend it with.
Yes.
And I think it goes for friendships as well. Yeah. Unhealthy friendships and unhealthy relationships with your loved ones. It's true. It does kind of bring you closer if you can take that perspective.
Yep.
So, okay. So we've learned a little bit more about you today, Seki. We've got to have brunch again.
Yes, why not? Let's do it.
But let's do it. But thank you so much for joining me and having brunch. I will not order pancakes for you next time. This is great.
Make sure you have your fork and your knife ready.
I will.
I need it sliced very specifically.
I might draw something on your pancake.
You might write something on my pancake.
In chocolate chip. This has been Saturday Brunch on The Genie Show with Dr. Seku Gathers. It's time to party, The Genie Show.
Hi, this is Brooke Devard from Naked Beauty. Are you tired of feeling housebound? I sure am. Break free with the new Unbound Cordless Auto Curler from Conair. It's a high-performance auto curler that's rechargeable and gives you up to 60 minutes of cord-free runtime. Just think of all of the incredible hair looks you can create in 60 minutes, unbound, away from your wall. Don't get tied down by cords. Love your look. Live unbound. Check it out at conair.com and search Unbound.